Introduction. The Buddhist monk Nagarjuna lived some 600 years after the Parinirvana of the Buddha in the 2nd or 3rd century CE. For many Buddhists, he is the greatest of the Indian Mahayana teachers. An original thinker, he was the author of the Majjhimaka Karika, or Verses on the Middle, the foundational text of the Majjhimaka school. Besides being the popularizer of the Pranyaparamita, or Perfection of Wisdom scriptures. The work on which this book is based, the Raja Parikatha Ratnamala, or Precious Garland of Advice for a King, is one of Nagarjuna's less well-known works, succinct, comprehensive and inspiring. It is a masterpiece of Mahayana expository literature. It deals with the two definitive, inseparable aspects of the Bodhisattva's life, the Bodhisattva being the ideal Buddhist of the Mahayana. These two aspects are the profound wisdom, which realizes the truth of emptiness, and the extensive compassion, which engages in activities for the benefit of others. The Ratnamala is, in fact, a Mahayana manual, a handbook of the Mahayana tradition, and a guide to living in accordance with Mahayana principles. The work is addressed to an unnamed king, supposedly one belonging to the South Indian Shatavarna dynasty. The Precious Garland's theme is the relationship between the practice of ethics and the attainment of wisdom. And in the course of the work, Nagarjuna explores this relationship from a number of different angles, chiefly in relation to various traditional formulas, such as the 10 ethical precepts, the 6 perfections, and the 57 faults to be abandoned. In the course of this exploration, he gives the king advice on a whole range of ethical matters, and it is this aspect of his advice to the king on which this book is based. Mahayana texts are not perhaps the first works of reference to which a Buddhist seeking advice on ethical matters will naturally turn. Among the range of scriptures and commentaries available to us, it may seem more obvious to look to the scriptures of earlier Buddhism, many of which spell out clearly and uncompromisingly the ethical conduct that supports the seeking of enlightenment. However, the Mahayana has plenty to say on the subject, and although it may seem strange that advice given by a monk to a king nearly 2,000 years ago has relevance for modern life, Nagarjuna's words are in fact extremely useful for anyone seeking to live a Buddhist life today. The basic principle of ethics, according to the Mahayana, is to help others. Whereas the view of the Hinayana, as Mahayanists call the earlier form of Buddhism, is that the practice of ethics is undertaken largely as an exercise in cultivating and preserving positive mental states. The Mahayana does not contradict this viewpoint, but simply regards a wholehearted concern for others as a more positive motivation than a concern for one's own mental states. Another Mahayana certainty is that ethical behaviour is grounded in perfect wisdom, and at the same time that the development of wisdom is only possible on the basis of an ethical life. That reciprocal relationship is the context, Mahayanists would say, in which the practice of ethics should be considered. It is entirely natural, therefore, that in the Precious Garland, Nagarjuna, that famed exponent of the perfection of wisdom, returns again and again to reconsider the basics of ethical life and practice. But before we look at what he has to say on the subject, we could usefully ask how we knew what he said. Where did these verses come from? And how have they reached us? Whereas the Buddha taught purely by word of mouth, and his teachings were preserved as an oral tradition for 400 years before they were written down in what we now know as the Pali Canon, by Nagarjuna's time, writing was in common use. And Nagarjuna's work was composed as a literary text, a short work addressed to a particular individual in the form of a letter. Nagarjuna wrote in Sanskrit, but the text on which this commentary is based is a translation from the Tibetan, and this calls for a word of explanation. Tibetan Buddhism, which also spread into Mongolia, Sikkim, Bhutan, and Ladakh, is one of three major historical forms of Buddhism that still flourish today, the others being Southeast Asian Buddhism, found in Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, and Laos, and Sino-Japanese Buddhism, found in Korea and Vietnam, as well as China and Japan. Each of these forms is a continuation of Indian Buddhism from a certain point in the history of its development, which continued until it was wiped out in the land of its birth by Muslim invaders in the 12th century. Indeed, the prominent position Nagarjuna's works assume in Tibetan literature is evidence of the continuity between Tibetan Buddhism and its Indian antecedents. Tibetan Buddhism is essentially the brilliant and complex Buddhism of the Pala dynasty in northeast India, supplemented by influences from Central Asia. The transmission of Buddhism from one country to another was not like taking an artifact from one place to another. Indian Buddhists, moving from the subtropical plains and forests of Bengal and Bihar across the huge barrier of the Himalayas into the icy, windswept tablelands of Tibet, were transporting not an object, but their practice and teaching. It was like the migration of a living species which faithfully continues to pass on its defining features from one generation to the next, while slowly adapting itself to its new environment, eventually to produce a distinct variant of the original species. Through its various schools, and through the outstanding personalities of teachers such as Milarepa and Tsongkhapa, Tibetan Buddhism has made original contributions of great value throughout its history while retaining the essential features of the Indian Mahayana. In its monastic organisation and teaching, Tibetan Buddhism perpetuates the Sarvastivada school of ancient Buddhist India. As regards tantric practice, it keeps alive the symbolic rituals and esoteric meditations of 100 different lineages of Indian yogis and adepts, and in the text it uses. Tibetan Buddhism preserves the scriptures imported from India with a high degree of accuracy. Sanskrit Buddhist manuscripts, where they exist at all, tend to be very corrupt, but Tibetan translations are very faithful to the originals. There is a further reason to trust the Tibetan translation. Although the text is a literary work, the translation we will be using here is based on an oral transmission involving not just the passing on of the text, but an explanation of it as well. If you read a text just by yourself, it might not yield much meaning, whereas if you are fortunate enough to be introduced to it by a competent teacher, you're likely to gain a deeper insight into what it's about. It is thus customary in Tibetan Buddhism to approach a text by going to a guru or teacher who is able to explain and interpret it in the light of what he knows about your own Buddhist practice. Eventually, you may in turn explain the text to your own students, and it is in this way that the essential meaning of the work is passed down the lineage. If the continuity of the lineage is interrupted, as sometimes happens, the correct interpretation might even be lost and have to be discovered afresh. In the case of some quite elementary works, this is perhaps not so important. But if the work is an abstruse or difficult one, as the present work undoubtedly is in parts, then the correct interpretation of the text becomes very important. In all Buddhist traditions, it's understood that reading a work by oneself does not really count. Prior to my own monastic ordination, for instance, I was asked exactly what texts I had read and studied in conjunction with a teacher, and these were the only texts I was credited with having read in any proper sense. This attitude is inherited from the earliest times, and the precious garland itself was composed to be studied in this way. It is not written for the uninitiated reader. It is a pithy presentation of the ideas of the Mahayana, suitable for oral explanation by a teacher such as Nagarjuna himself. But if it is best to depend upon the interpretation of a teacher, what is the role of the scholar in aiding our understanding of a text like this? In any discussion of the development of Buddhist ideas, there are, at the very least, two very different viewpoints, that of the modern scholarship on the one hand and that of traditional Buddhism on the other. The traditional Indo-Tibetan point of view is that the Mahayana teaching was delivered in its fullness, exactly as expressed in the Mahayana sutras by the Buddha, but that by the time of Nagarjuna, approximately 700 years after the Buddha's death, it had disappeared from view and had to be revived, and in some cases rediscovered, by the Majjhimika and Yogacara masters. From the point of view of modern scholarship, however, the Buddha could not have taught the Mahayana sutras, certainly not in the form in which they've come down to us. Perhaps certain things he said and certain teachings he gave contained the seeds that later developed into the Mahayana. But the modern scholar would regard Nagarjuna as having cultivated those seeds and produced from them something that was not previously envisaged. They would not accept the claim of the Mahayana that Nagarjuna was simply the reviver of teachings that had already blossomed in the original dispensation of a Buddha. These two views are obviously in conflict, but that's not to say that one is right and the other is wrong. The middle way is to give appropriate weight to each view. Clearly, it's not possible to accept that the Mahayana sutras were taught by the Buddha exactly as they've come down to us. At the same time, it's important to affirm that they do fully reflect the spirit of the Buddha's original teaching, albeit recast in another form at a later time. We can certainly see in the Pali text not only seeds but quite definite statements of teachings that come out more fully later on in the Mahayana tradition. This difficulty arises when one is studying any Buddhist text, even the suttas of the Pali canon, which Theravadin Buddhists traditionally claim to be literally the word of the Buddha. It is seldom easy to tell, even with these, to what extent they can be regarded as the actual words of the Buddha, and to what extent they are later reshapings of his original message. In all likelihood, texts like the Udana or the Sutta Nipata come as close as anything in the Buddhist canon to telling us what the Buddha said and how he said it, but works whose literary forms reveal that they originated later may reflect the spirit of the Buddha's teaching just as faithfully. There's a fine line to be drawn between the spirit of the teaching and the letter. And while scholarship is very helpful in any examination of the letter of the text as a text, the guidance of a teacher will bring us closer to the spiritual meaning of that text. This is a process that takes place whenever someone who has realized the spirit of the teaching is engaged in trying to pass on that teaching. Thus, in the precious garland, we could say that Nagarjuna is cultivating seeds that are already present in the perfection of wisdom, Pranya Paramita sutras. And the sutra on the 10 stages, Dasha Bhumika, for the benefit of his audience, the king, and giving a new form to the essential spirit of these teachings. In studying classics of Tibetan Buddhist literature, such as Nagarjuna's precious garland, we therefore come a good deal closer to the mainstream of Indian Mahayana doctrine and practice than we might at first have thought. We can take it that the words ascribed to Nagarjuna are indeed his, and that the precious garland gives us an authentic account of the communication between teacher and royal student. Needless to say, there is no royal road to perfect wisdom. The text soon makes it clear that, like anyone else, the king will need to pay attention to his ethical life if he is to become truly wise. Living ethically is essentially about developing compassion, and compassion in the eyes of Mahayana Buddhism is coordinate with wisdom, wisdom and compassion being the two wings by means of which the bird of enlightenment can fly. As well as giving the king a great deal of specific advice about how to live ethically, Nagarjuna makes various suggestions as to why one should do so. These are scattered throughout the precious garland, as though at various points the king needs to be encouraged or provoked into greater efforts. Nagarjuna uses a combination of carrots and sticks. On the one hand, he points out that ethical behaviour is the basis of wisdom and that skillful action leads to happiness, whether in this life or the next. On the other hand, he issues sober warnings about the impermanence of life and about the serious consequences of unskillful actions. Skillful behaviour is thus shown to be the road to a wise and happy life, and also the way to avoid pain and misery. What follows is a brief survey of Nagarjuna's reflections on the necessity of ethical living and the nature of its rewards. Quote, O King, I will explain practices solely virtuous to generate in you the doctrine, for the practices will be established in a vessel of the excellent doctrine. End quote. The central idea expressed here is that ethical practice is the basis upon which wisdom may be developed. Nagarjuna lays out his aims, which are not to impart doctrinal information, but to plant seeds of the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching. The word doctrine perhaps suggests something that is understood intellectually, but the Dharma is to be realised in every fibre of one's being. Nagarjuna's organic metaphor, generate, reflects this deeper meaning. It suggests that what he's going to say is intended to spark off something that will become the king's own realization, something that will be brought to birth within him, something that will live and thrive. In other words, Nagarjuna proposes to generate in the king not merely an understanding of the Dharma, but the Dharma itself. Just as the Buddha did not speak about the Dharma, but simply spoke Dharma. Nagarjuna doesn't want merely to talk about the truth. He wants to awaken the king to the truth. He is reminding the king of his inherent potential to attain enlightenment, to establish the practices, and to become thereby a vessel of the Dharma. When Nagarjuna speaks of the excellent doctrine in the fourth line, the addition of an adjective is not just to fill up the verse line. In ancient Buddhist literature, especially verse, every word or syllable contributes to the meaning. He therefore refers to something slightly different from just doctrine on its own, which appears in the second line. In the second line, the Dharma is the fruit of solely or simply virtuous practices. This Dharma is real enough. It is a living spiritual principle, a practical realization of what is skillful and what is unskillful, but it can be practiced even by a beginner. We can assume that the king did not know very much Dharma, if any at all. As a result, Nagarjuna begins by speaking about morality. He wants to inspire the king to spark off a more positive state of mind. The term translated as excellent doctrine, however, is sadharma, which means the true or real dharma, the ultimate dharma, the dharma that is directly concerned with reality. Nagarjuna foresees that as the king becomes established in the moral practices he takes up, he will become receptive to the dharma at a significantly higher level. When people first become interested in the spiritual life, they're not necessarily looking for profound philosophical teachings, or even if they are, these may not be what is most useful for them to hear. To begin with, they need something that will give them a feeling for states of mind more positive than the ones they usually experience. They don't need facts and figures about the history of Buddhism. They don't need requests for donations. Nagarjuna, therefore, does not burden the king with a discussion of the finer points of the Abhidharma or of Mahayana philosophy, at least not yet. Nor does he bother his wealthy and influential student with requests for funds with which to build monasteries. If he cannot inspire the king from the start, he might as well save himself the trouble of trying to teach him anything, let alone the excellent doctrine. Nagarjuna's vessel of the excellent doctrine is a description of a practitioner of the Dharma. Another teacher compares the four different kinds of disciple to four kinds of pots. The first kind is like a pot that is turned upside down. He or she is completely unreceptive. The second is like a pot with holes in the bottom. Just as whatever you pour into the pot leaks away, likewise whatever is communicated to this sort of disciple goes in one ear and out the other. They might seem to understand at the time, but nothing is retained long enough to make any real impression. The next kind of disciple is like a pot containing poison, full of negative mental states like resentment, craving, and cynicism. Such a disciple will corrupt and distort the teaching in such a way as to make it harmful to themselves and to others. Finally, there is the disciple who's like a pot that is clean, intact and empty, ready to receive the Dharma. This sort of disciple is ready to receive the Dharma. He or she is the vessel of the excellent doctrine of which Nagarjuna speaks. The king's task is to become such a vessel. Quote, in one who first practices high status, definite goodness arises later. For having attained high status, one comes gradually to definite goodness. End quote. High status and definite goodness are important terms within the Ratnamala. High status means a happy, positive, and even prominent situation within conditioned existence. In the context of the Tibetan Wheel of Life, the term means a good rebirth in the human realm or among the gods. It is a goal that tradition often assigns to the laity, especially in Theravada countries. By observing the precepts, worshipping at stupas and giving alms and donations to monks, one generates good karma and thus earns the positive but still mundane fruits of that karma, without necessarily concerning oneself with the ultimate goal of Buddhism. Definite goodness, on the other hand, refers to those qualities that make for insight, for liberation from conditioned existence, for nirvana. According to Nagarjuna, one who seeks to lead a spiritual life first improves their position within samsara, the round of mundane existence, and then goes on to cultivate definite goodness, the urge for liberation. Put like that, what he's saying is obviously true, but does everyone who attains high status necessarily start thinking in terms of definite goodness, in the sense of trying to realise the inherently insubstantial and impermanent nature of conditioned existence? No, certainly not. We cannot assume that this higher aspiration will arise automatically as the result of a mere accumulation of punya or merit and the attainment of high status. It will arise only if you start thinking seriously about the unsatisfactory nature of conditioned existence itself, despite your enjoyment of high status within it. Like many traditional teachings, the Ratnamala is meant for a particular audience. Everyone needs the Dharma to be presented to them in a way that will harness their personal predispositions and energies. Here, Nagarjuna is addressing a king. The traditional Indian belief was that if you were born into a royal family, it was on account of previous good karma. Nagarjuna is in effect saying that since, as a result of his previous virtuous deeds, the king has attained high status, he should now think of achieving or developing definite goodness. He is presenting this as the next natural step, the only real option for a sensible person. The king's merits having gained for him the highest status it's possible to achieve in life, he seems to be saying there is really only one further step for him to take. Once you assume that a certain course of events will naturally follow from what you are doing now, it will often be those very events that take place. If you have made up your mind about the course before you, there can be a sense of inevitability about it, even though you have to continue to make an effort in that direction. Nagarjuna is perhaps trying to encourage the king and to persuade him that his achievement of high status is just the foundation for this decisive step on the spiritual path. This example of skillful means should not blind us to the fact that in reality there is no summit to human felicity. There is no point at which you will be sure to say to yourself, "Well, I've come as far as one can get in this world, now for something of an entirely different nature." There is, that is to say, no end to human craving. One never feels that one has enough. Even a man who has contrived to bring a whole nation under his control might well want to extend his power still further. If they are to make spiritual progress, it would seem that people need to experience a few unpleasant shocks just to make them think seriously. If things are going along smoothly, you might start taking everything for granted and become unmindful of the impermanence and fragility of human existence, in which case your high status would not have helped you progress towards the goal at all. This is a subject to which Nagarjuna turns later in the text. Quote, "Always considering that impermanence of life, health and dominion, you thereby will make intense efforts solely at the practices. Seeing that death is certain and that, having died, you suffer from ill deeds, you should not commit ill deeds, though there might be temporary pleasure. Sometimes no horror is seen, and sometimes it is. If there is comfort in one, why do you have no fear for the other?" End quote. If the promise of happiness is not incentive enough to practice, consider, says Nagarjuna, how precarious is our hold upon life. We assume that we'll live out our allotted span of years, but this is by no means certain. Even in the conditions of modern life, the possible causes of death are legion, while the factors keeping us alive are comparatively few, and even they can become causes of death. Food, for example, keeps us alive, but there are so many cases, including that of the Buddha himself, in which it has brought a swift end instead. The fact of impermanence manifests in a thousand different ways. If we look at life dispassionately and in detail, we can see the changes almost as they occur. Though these changes may be quite small, As we get older, they add up to a process of increasing physical and mental decline. We are likely to acknowledge this decline sadly and reluctantly, even anxiously, but it is possible to see it as something from which we can draw strength and determination. It is even possible to draw inspiration from events that jolt us into greater awareness, such as some sudden change in health or fortunes, or perhaps a brush with death. In fact, we have every reason to take such reminders of impermanence as a spur to the spiritual practice. It is obvious that we don't have much time, and that we may lose the faculties that we now possess. Life will become more difficult as we get older. In many ways, we who live in advanced democracies live like kings, but the privileges we enjoy, especially the freedom and opportunity to practice the Dharma, may not always be available to us. As the fact of impermanence reminds us, life is a brief and precious opportunity, an opportunity to be seized with enthusiasm. Don't wait until you have more time, just do it now, in the midst of everything else that you have to do. The message of impermanence is the message of the Dharma itself. Impermanence is a death sentence, but it's also our hope of freedom from death, if only we can accept its message at the deepest level of our being and heed its warning. For Nagarjuna, impermanence does not imply nihilism, the belief that death is the end. In the West, we tend to regard a belief in a future life or lives as reassuring, but such a prospect is not reassuring for Nagarjuna or for any true Buddhist. The translation, ill deeds, is perhaps not the happiest, but the message is clear. What Nagarjuna is saying is, how can you take comfort from the fact that despite your misdeeds you appear to enjoy a good life now? You may relax when you see nothing threatening coming upon you in this life, but when you do experience the operation of karma, why do you not take it as a warning that you should mend your ways? Here is the paradoxical nature of human self-delusion. We take comfort when we don't see the karmic results of our unskillful actions, but we don't heed the warning when we do. This at least is the traditional message. I would not put it that way myself, however. I would prefer to say that unskillful actions hinder our development as human beings and therefore undermine our happiness. They certainly undermine the happiness that results from a good conscience. Why sacrifice real happiness for the sake of some transitory pleasure? An aspect of high status that is easy to assume is spiritually advantageous, but which is not necessarily so, is the possession of physical and mental health. It might be assumed that if you're physically healthy and active, mentally robust and socially adept, you will necessarily be more receptive to the Dharma. However, being healthy sometimes comes with a sort of beefy and unreflecting insensitivity, while people who are unwell or unsuccessful in worldly terms, even people who are emotionally disturbed, are sometimes more spiritually sensitive and receptive. In other words, skillful in its Buddhist sense is not equivalent to healthy. That is, the criteria of psychological health espoused by psychotherapeutic or psychoanalytic theory do not quite correspond with Buddhist ideas of what constitutes a mentally healthy human being. For example, a common rule of thumb used to estimate reasonable mental health is the ability to hold down a job. But the possession of spiritually skillful mental states can go with an inability to conform to worldly expectations that can render a person virtually unemployable. It is as if a little insight sets you going against the grain of the world. You might perhaps become a little eccentric, even unstable. Someone who is healthy in the worldly sense might appear to be a more likely vessel for the Dharma, but a rather more battered specimen of humanity even someone straight out of mental hospital or jail, might prove to be much more successful Dharma practitioner. To be skillful in the Buddhist sense means to act, speak, and think in a way that takes one away from what are traditionally known as the three poisons: craving, hatred, and bewilderment or mental confusion. You may be healthy in the worldly sense, may function very well in society, and be successful and even happy. But unless you have sufficient insight to perceive the ways in which you are affected by the three poisons, you are not healthy in the Buddhist sense. Quote, high status is considered to be happiness. Definite goodness is liberation. The quintessence of their means is briefly faith and wisdom. End quote. Here, Nagarjuna distinguishes between two ways of thinking. You can think in terms of gaining happiness, in which case you are still concerned with the world, or you can think in terms of gaining liberation. The difference is quite significant. The worldly-minded person asks, usually unconsciously, "What will make me happy?" The spiritually-minded person, on the other hand, asks consciously, "How can I become free?" If you are a healthy person in the ordinary sense of the word, you are likely to judge how well you're doing in terms of how happy you feel. This translates, objectively speaking, into what Nagarjuna terms high status. However, happiness is not a very reliable guideline. If you do something because you think it will make you happy, the chances are that you will be disappointed, and in all likelihood your search for ways to be happy will continue indefinitely. There will never be an object that can give you the happiness you seek. You will just go from one thing to another, becoming more and more frustrated, bored, disappointed, dissatisfied, and unhappy. On the other hand, if you're thinking in terms of definite goodness, you will not worry too much about immediate happiness, which means, strangely enough, that you're much more likely to find it. Happiness is a byproduct of the quest for freedom. Quote, having analysed well all deeds of body, speech and mind, those who realise what benefits self and others and always perform these are wise. End quote. Nagarjuna's conception of wisdom as including the realisation of what benefits self and others is thoroughly Mahayanist, in that it accepts the Bodhisattva ideal with its aims of enlightenment for oneself and others. The traditional phrase is not to be taken too literally, because to an enlightened one there is ultimately no distinction between self and others, but it is meaningful for the non-enlightened mind and helps to break down that distinction on an emotional level. It also makes it absolutely clear that we're not being asked to put our own happiness to one side altogether in our concern for the happiness of others. One might say that Nagarjuna's aim in writing this letter to the king is to direct him towards true happiness as distinct from the transitory happiness of worldly success. But if the quest for happiness is subsequently to be put aside in the transition from seeking high status to seeking definite goodness, this does not mean that there is anything wrong with wanting to be happy. It's a natural and healthy human impulse. How can we wish for the happiness of others if we are alienated from our own desire for happiness? Unfortunately, many of us in the West were given to understand when we were young that it is selfish to want happiness for oneself, and we therefore feel unnecessarily guilty about wanting it. As a result, we can feel guilty even about being happy. After all, the perverse logic goes, with all my selfish desires for my own happiness, how could I possibly deserve to be happy? This further produces the still more perverse belief that if we are to make spiritual progress, we will necessarily have to subject ourselves to great suffering. Such a deep-down belief that you're undeserving, even basically wicked, will inhibit your practice of the Dharma from the very beginning. This unfortunate state of affairs arises partly from our failure to distinguish between happiness and the good on the one hand and what is pleasant on the other. If we are to lead a spiritual life, it's imperative that we distinguish between happiness and pleasure. We have to realise that doing what is good for us is not the same thing as doing what we like or what we enjoy. However, it can sometimes be so difficult to disentangle the two that it's tempting to assume that the good cannot be pleasant and that the pleasant is bound to do us harm. To avoid following one's blind desires, one may even make it a rule always to follow the advice of others and do what they think is best for one. From this, it's only a short step to thinking that one's natural desire to benefit oneself and to be happy is reprehensible. If you find yourself in this sort of dilemma, it might be best just to do what you enjoy doing, regardless of people's approval or disapproval, and in this way, re-establish contact with your feelings. Ideally, we should act spontaneously, with ease and flexibility, rather than acting out of a sense of being hedged in on every side by self-recrimination or out of fear of transgressing some immutable moral law. Having said that, our wider aim should be to reach out beyond our personal happiness towards what is of profounder concern to us, namely benefiting others. If you succeed in doing this, you are being a true friend to yourself. Quote, "Always observe the discipline of actions, just as it has been explained. In that way, O glorious one, you will become the best of authoritative beings upon the earth. You should always analyse well everything before you act, and through seeing things correctly as they are, do not put full reliance on others. Through these practices, your realm will be happy. A broad canopy of fame will rise in all directions, and your officials will respect you fully. The causes of death are many, those of staying alive are few. These too can become causes of death. Therefore, always perform the practices. If you always perform thus the practices, the mental happiness which arises in the world and in yourself is most favourable. Through the practices you will sleep happily and will awaken happily. Because your inner nature will be without defect, even your dreams will be happy. Intent on serving your parents, respectful to the principles of your lineage, using your resources well, patient, generous, with kindly speech, without divisiveness and truthful. Through performing such discipline for one lifetime, you will become a monarch of gods, whereupon, even more so, you will be a monarch of gods. Therefore, observe such practices." Here Nagarjuna is suggesting to the king that having obtained the acme of worldly power, prosperity and happiness through having performed virtuous deeds in previous lives, his next step is to become king of the gods through further virtuous deeds in this life. As king of the gods, he will be in a position of still greater influence, of course. One has only to think of Brahma Sahampati's urging the Buddha to teach the Dharma to get some idea of what kind of influence that might be. One of the fruits of spiritual practice is clarity, seeing things just as they are. Less coloured by self-interest and personal predicaments, one's views are more objective, and one has less need to rely on the views of others for a kind of second-hand objectivity. The other major fruit is happiness. Nagarjuna's reminder that happiness is beneficial may seem an obvious point, but it's one that's little regarded. Happiness is not only good in itself, but produces further positive results. If you can make people a little happier, cheer them up a bit, there is that much more positive energy moving around. To say, "even your dreams will be happy," seems to be a common way in Indian literature of talking about exceptional good fortune. Quote, "Through faith, you will not be without leisure. Through good ethics, you will move in good transmigrations. Through becoming familiar with emptiness, you will attain detachment from all phenomena." End quote. The results to be looked for are not necessarily experienced in this life. If in this life you have faith, you will have leisure, presumably for hearing the Dharma, in the next. So why does Nagarjuna make a connection between faith and having leisure? The point is that if you have faith in the Dharma, you will make the best use of whatever opportunities you have to practice it here and now, as you are aware how precious those opportunities are. In fact, you will do whatever you can to increase them. The word leisure should not be taken too literally. Among the traditional list of 8 conditions of non-leisure, along with various more obviously unsatisfactory rebirths, is rebirth as a long-lived god. The holding of wrong views is also mentioned. The next consequence of skillful behaviour mentioned by Nagarjuna relates to an important Buddhist teaching. The practice of ethics is the key to a healthy human existence, whether in this life or the next. The connection he goes on to make is in a sense equally obvious. Insight leads to non-attachment. But the idea of being familiar with emptiness suggests more than the occasional flash of insight. It suggests something that has sunk in so deep that it's become the way one normally sees things. The question is whether we have to achieve this first, or whether breaking down our attachments in other ways will by itself give us an appreciation of emptiness. It seems to be a question of freedom versus discipline. Suppose, for instance, that you're very attached to chocolate. You can either gorge on it until you become sick of chocolate, or you can discipline yourself to give up the indulgence little by little. Both methods work. The insight can arrive either way. But neither method produces insight automatically. Even if you don't give up chocolate, you will in any case need to keep up your practice of reflection and meditation in order to see through the craving. If you give up chocolate as a matter of discipline, on the other hand, you can cut down the craving for it enough to allow you to start to see your habits more clearly. Reducing the craving leaves you freer to examine it. Discipline tends to simplify your life. It gives you more energy, and it helps to maintain morale and momentum. If a number of individuals undertake the same discipline and support one another in it, that also strengthens the Sangha, as the Buddhist community is called. However, while discipline certainly makes insight more likely through its attenuating of craving, no amount of discipline is a substitute for seeing into the true nature of your craving, which is that it's the cause of suffering. Crucially, discipline enables you to see the workings of your mind and get a sense of how you would get on if you didn't indulge that particular desire. If you were to fast for 3 days, say, you would see how your mind works without the physical and emotional support of food. You would see how you feel about food, what it means to you. It's like a laboratory experiment. You take away a certain factor in your life, so that you can see what happens when that factor is not present. You don't have to guess. You actually see and feel the result, and as a consequence, you know yourself better. You might then want to make a vow. A vow is very simply a statement, usually a public statement, to the effect that you will do or not do something, either for a certain period of time or forever. Not that you'll try to, not that you promise to, you will. When you make the vow, it's already accomplished and there's no question of your breaking it. To make the vow is to keep it. Even if you don't say it in front of other people, you say it in front of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and you call upon them to witness your vow. Having done that, there's no going back, so that when you make a vow, you need to know what you are doing and why. For example, you should know yourself well enough not to make a vow out of self-hatred, just as a way of making life difficult for yourself. Although, even if you did this, you would still have to keep the vow. Should you break a vow, it means you didn't really make it in the first place, and this will show that you are not an emotionally integrated person. To make a vow presupposes a certain degree of integration. But if you haven't got that when you make the vow, one of the purposes of the vow is to make you become integrated in the course of its fulfillment. In fact, you become more integrated even as you bring yourself to the point of making it. Without being integrated, you won't be able to observe the vow. And as there's no question of your not observing it, you just have to become integrated. There is no other way. Quote, desisting from all non-virtues and always engaging in virtues with body, speech and mind. These are called the three forms of practice. Through these practices one is freed from becoming a hell being, hungry ghost or animal. Reborn as a human or god, one gains extensive happiness, fortune and dominion. End quote. The states of being of the denizens of hell, of hungry ghosts, praetors, and of animals are usually designated the three downward paths. It is axiomatic, not only for traditional Buddhism, but for Indian culture generally, that the performance of virtuous actions raises one in the scale of conditioned existence and increases one's happiness and well-being. In other words, virtue pays, in the form of what the translation calls high status. It is very much the Indian belief that a life of virtue will not only raise the level of your consciousness, but also produce mundane rewards in the form of a rebirth in which you will have a pleasant and happy time, in which you will be rich, good-looking, and so on. In most Buddhist countries, lay people observe the precepts largely for this reason. I personally doubt whether the karma operates quite so straightforwardly as that. In any case, the attitude of measuring the morality of actions by how far they're going to advance you in this world or the next is hardly a spiritual one. It's no more spiritual to think in terms of being reborn in a heaven realm than it is to want to be rich and successful in the present life. Both are inadequate solutions to the problem of human suffering. A utilitarian belief in karma is at best an incentive to moral action for people who are only able to think in very materialistic terms. No doubt this is an important consideration. If people are encouraged to behave well, out of concern for their own well-being in a future life, it's a good beginning. But we need to be weaned off any dependency on that kind of incentive, for it inevitably compromises the purity of the intention behind moral action, and thus also compromises the spiritual effectiveness of that action. Taken too literally or carried too far, This attitude towards the practice of ethics becomes what Swami Vivekananda once called a shopkeeper's religion, a trading of good deeds for future worldly benefits. You might even find yourself calculating, for example, that, having built up a nice surplus of moral credit, you could well afford to backslide in a certain area of your ethical practice. Such naive spiritual materialism is unlikely to attract many people these days. The only people who would be motivated by it would probably be those involved in religious movements that interpret worldly prosperity as a sign of God's approval, or which promise the joys of heaven to the virtuous believer. The only truly spiritual measure of moral actions is whether or not they lead to nirvana, or at least contribute to the basis upon which nirvana is attained. That is, whether or not they are performed out of a conscious concern for others as well as for oneself. Another way of putting this is simply to say that a truly virtuous action is its own reward. What better incentive for cultivating a generous, open state of mind than knowing it will lead to even more positive states and ultimately to enlightenment? If your skillful states of mind result in wealth and prosperity, there's no harm done, but such material rewards can only be a byproduct of truly skillful behaviour, not its raison d'être. Quote, "How could those with senseless, deviant minds on a path to bad transmigrations, wretched, intent on deceiving others, have understood what is meaningful? How could those intent on deceiving others be persons of policy? Through it they themselves will be cheated in many thousands of births. Even if you seek to harm an enemy, you should remove your own defects and cultivate good qualities. Through that you will help yourself, and the enemy will be displeased." End quote. These verses expose the sheer pointlessness of unskillful activities of body, speech, and mind. Such activities cut us off from any possibility of mental clarity. Not only do we create suffering for ourselves, we lose our way, we lose sight of the path away from suffering. We lose any clear sense of our own good, of what is truly meaningful. In cheating others, one cheats oneself in a way that outweighs any possible advantage that may be derived from deceit. Again, of course, it's very difficult to see this when one is dominated by a deceitful mindset. What is worse, it means that one is a stranger to the highly positive experience of unlimited and universal loving kindness, known in the Buddhist tradition as metta, Pali, or Maitri, Sanskrit. The advice in the third of these verses seems quite cynical, coming as it does from a great Buddhist philosopher, but we have to remember that it's given with the king's royal responsibilities in mind. A king may have enemies, in the sense of enemies of the state, without anything really personal being involved, and he will have to deal with such political foes effectively, even have to prevail over them without doing them more harm than was necessary. The principle seems straightforward. Even if your motivation is impure and you want to get the better of someone, you're still obliged to be considerate. It will benefit you, karmically speaking, as well as influencing the way others view you. And it will discomfort your opponents if they have to revise their opinion of you. St. Paul says something similar. By being kind to your enemy, you heap coals of fire on his head. Quote, "From non-virtues come all suffering, and likewise all bad transmigrations. From virtues all happy transmigrations and the pleasures of all lives." End quote. Some Buddhists believe that all our sufferings are due to misdeeds committed in previous lives, so we have to be quite careful about how we understand Nagarjuna's assertions here. It's not that all our sufferings are the direct result of unskillful actions on our part. Certainly an unskillful action will sooner or later be followed by suffering for the person who performs it. But this is not to say that if something unpleasant befalls us, it must be because of our previous unskillful actions. The fact is that sometimes we do feel that we suffer quite undeservedly, and the Buddhist view is that this feeling may be justified. Some of our experience is the result of karma, but some of it is the result of conditions of another kind. What we can say is that all our suffering is indirectly the result of our past unskillful actions. If we take the long view, we find that it's our own thoughts, words, and deeds that have brought us rebirth in the human realm. It is our own mental attitudes that have brought us into conditioned existence, and conditioned existence means suffering. The misfortunes we experience, often through no fault of our own, are an integral part of the mode of being within which our consciousness arose. The way Shantideva puts it in the Bodhicharyavatara is that if someone beats you, they must bear the responsibility for taking up the stick, but you must bear the responsibility for having taken up the body that is beaten. It is your own deluded consciousness that has brought about rebirth in the human realm, where such things as this may well happen. Quote, "Thus observe the practices incessantly and abandon those counter to them. If you and the world wish to attain unparalleled enlightenment, its roots are the altruistic aspiration to enlightenment, firm like the monarch of mountains, compassion reaching to all quarters, and wisdom not relying on duality." End quote. As we have seen, there are all kinds of traditional incentives and warnings relating to the connection between ethical conduct and one's own happiness and well-being. But of course, it is just as important, especially for the Mahayana, to consider the welfare of others. Nagarjuna now puts before the king the Mahayana ideal, that is, the Bodhisattva ideal. This ideal is the attainment of unparalleled enlightenment, and its roots are the three factors that will help bring this about. The first of these is the altruistic aspiration, which is the bodhicitta, the wish to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. This sublime aspiration is so imbued with a sense of the transcendental, and at the same time so deeply interwoven with one's everyday life, that it is unshakable. The second root is compassion, that is without boundaries, that does not falter under any circumstances, whatever the provocation. The third is wisdom, that is ungraspable, that gives the ego no foothold. Quote, "You should cause the assembling of the religious and the worldly through giving, speaking pleasantly, purposeful behaviour, and concordant behaviour." End quote. Much of Nagarjuna's advice to the king is offered in terms of the traditional ethical formula of the 10 precepts, and that is the basis of the following sections of this book. However, Nagarjuna also refers briefly to another traditional list, the Samgraha Vastus, the four means of unification by which the Bodhisattva brings people together to work for the common enterprise of creating, mythically speaking, a pure land. Firstly, giving or generosity is the way in which we connect in the most practical manner with others. We let go of our tight grip on what belongs to us, whether material goods, money, time, or energy. That which expresses our possessiveness is transformed into a means of expressing its complete opposite. No doubt the recipient is pleased to receive what we give, but more important is the sense of care and concern that any gesture communicates. Above all, we give the Dharma. We don't distinguish between our personal practice of the Dharma and our communication of it to others. The second of the Sangravastus is affectionate speech. As we shall see later, in greater detail, right speech is greatly emphasized in Buddhism. It's not just a matter of the content of our communication. Much of our communication is conveyed in our tone of voice, which often reflects our true feelings much more accurately than what we are actually saying. At the same time, it's more difficult to monitor this feature of our speech because it's much closer to a true communication of ourselves. By the same token, however, if we consciously cultivate affectionate speech, this can change us at quite a deep level. The third means of unification is beneficial activity. This is not just a matter of helping others. It's also a matter of knowing what would be of most benefit to them, as well as understanding how best to employ one's energy. After all, there's a lot to be done and one's energy is limited. What would benefit people most of all at the deepest level is helping them to access their own energy by sparking them off, getting them going, inspiring them in some way. The fourth Sangrahavastu is exemplification, or practicing what one preaches. The Dharma is a teaching that has to be realized in daily life, and it is in this way that it's truly communicated. Do we exemplify the qualities that we're asking others to develop? If not, and if there's a discrepancy between the way we are and the way we aspire to be, clearly something is lacking. What is lacking is not so much the ability to be other than we are at present, but the courage to be honest about where we really stand. If we can do this, even though it's quite difficult or humiliating to admit our deficiencies to ourselves, let alone to others, then we are already making great progress. After all, reality is not a comfortable experience for the ego. In the precious garland, the Samgrahavastus are part of Nagarjuna's guidance to the king, not a bodhisattva. And in fact, these practices are relevant at every stage of one's spiritual development. They embody the fundamental virtues of generosity, gentleness, helpfulness, and authenticity, and they can be cultivated in all sorts of ordinary ways. Quote, not killing, not stealing, forsaking the mates of others, refraining completely from false, divisive, harsh, and senseless speech, thoroughly forsaking covetousness, harmful intent, and the views of nihilists. These are the 10 gleaming paths of action. Their opposites are dark. End quote. In these two verses, Nagarjuna introduces the precepts on which his advice to the king is mainly based, seeking to make the point that the basis of wisdom is ethics. He spells out in the clearest terms what an ethical life involves. These verses refer to the 10 traditional vows or precepts, the Dasha Kusala Karmapatas, or 10 ways of skillful action. A precept is a training principle, a guideline to ethical behaviour in a certain area of life. The importance of observing the precepts consists not in obeying the rules or in being good, but in cultivating skillful ways of being and behaving for their own sake. In that respect, there's always more to do. You throw yourself wholeheartedly into your ethical practice, but you're aware at the same time that you may sometimes backslide, at least to a degree. If that happens, you have to begin again from where you left off and try not to indulge in guilty self-recrimination. These precepts make up a path of practice rather than being a list of fixed rules or rigid prohibitions. An ethical precept isn't an absolute in the sense of being something you're either observing or not observing. As long as one is living with the precepts in mind, one's practice could always be worse and always be better. There is always further to fall and always further to go. The precepts are therefore weightier than our limited experience of them usually allows us to realise. A potential problem is that the notion of precepts as training principles might cause us to feel, consciously or unconsciously, that we're being let off the hook a little. One might say to oneself, "Well, perhaps I'm a bit lax in my attempts to be a vegetarian, but one of these days I'm going to do something about it." Speech? Well, I'm afraid little white lies are a necessary part of doing business, and it's obvious that a little fruity language helps to get your point across. But perhaps when I get into a management position. Yes, of course I could be more scrupulous in the way I administer the petty cash, if only I could get away with paying a little less tax. You know, I'm only getting drunk twice a week now that I'm no longer working behind the bar, so I'm in a much better state of mind most of the time. Of course, this is a caricature, but perhaps not much of a one. Although we should be careful not to be too legalistic about observing the precepts, they call for more than a vague intention to behave better in future. We can try, for example, to be more imaginative in the way we approach them, especially by cultivating their positive counterparts, being kinder, more generous, more faithful, in thought and speech as well as in deed. More truthful, more mindful. We can look for new ways in which to express these positive, expansive qualities. As we shall see in the following chapters, the 10 precepts deserve considerable thought and reflection. They go far beyond our usual conceptions of ethics.